Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and a challenge. Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host again for this edition. In today's show, we'll turn once again to the situation in Ukraine. The Biden administration is now proposing some $40 billion in military aid to Ukraine, exceeding the previous recent proposal by enough money to provide universal health care for everyone in the U.S. for a year. If you listen to commentary on most media outlets in the U.S., it ranges from pro-war to even more adamantly pro-war, following a familiar pattern that we saw during the U.S. war in Iraq. Divergent viewpoints, several of which you'll hear in today's program, are omitted, ignored, or even ridiculed and condemned, while the State Department view, which much of the media echoes, seems narrowly focused on the notion of a Ukrainian victory against a Russian aggressor. But what would such a victory mean? What would the relationships in the region look like, and how would the balance of power shift among the international superpowers, chiefly the U.S. and Russia? These questions are largely unexamined as the media discussion devolves into what kind of weapons are we sending and what are their capabilities. Clearly, the U.S. peace movement, such as it is divided, with some opposing all wars in principle but uncertain as to how to respond to this one. Others make an exception in this case, citing the legitimate need for Ukrainian self-defense, and yet still others blame the United States for steering the conflict away from diplomatic solutions, even as they acknowledge that Russia may not be a trustworthy participant in diplomatic negotiations or treaties. Of course, neither is the U.S. historically. Comparisons between the Ukraine conflict and the U.S. war in Iraq, or Israel's ethnic cleansing and conquest of Palestine with unconditional U.S. backing from one administration to the next, have been drawn by U.S. peace activists and scholars, and even by Ukrainian President Zelensky himself, which is all the more poignant today in light of Israel's targeted assassination of a prominent U.S. journalist this week who was chronicling yet another Israeli raid on the West Bank. Indeed, Israel may be using the diversion of attention to Ukraine as cover to radically ramp up construction of illegal settlements in occupied Palestine, even as we speak. An announced 4,000 new settlements have been proposed just this week. Two of the panelists in today's discussion make that comparison as well. The views expressed by today's panelists in this webinar hosted by the Institute for Policy Studies are somewhat divergent, and each is presented calmly and directly. It's refreshing to me not only to hear divergent viewpoints of, that differ from the prevailing narrative, but especially to hear them expressed in a civil and informative discourse. I hope you'll find the following to be just that. Here's part of the recent webinar featuring Phyllis Bennis, who I've occasionally featured on this show, along with John Pfeffer and Curry Peterson-Smith.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tope Falerin, and I'm the Executive Director at the Institute for Policy Studies. I'm so happy to welcome you to our fourth Institute for Policy Studies Lunch Table Talk. IPS is a research organization that works with social movements to turn progressive policy ideas into action. This series is a casual space for our expert researchers to share what they've been working on recently. I'm so pleased to introduce Phyllis Bennis, who directs our new internationalism project here at IPS, John Pfeffer, who directs our foreign policy and focus project, and Curry Peterson-Smith, who is our Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow. We'll be talking about the crisis in Ukraine, and our experts will provide their analysis about the latest developments there. I thought I'd start with John and ask if you could just provide like a brief overview of what's happening in Ukraine right now so we can have a kind of sort of foundation for this conversation.
Sure. Thanks, Tope, and thanks everyone for joining us today. I'll keep this brief because we got a lot of questions and I'm sure you have more of them. As most of you know, I'm sure the war in Ukraine has not gone as Moscow had initially anticipated. In other words, the effort to take control of Kiev and other major cities largely failed. Russian forces pulled back from surrounding Kiev and other major cities to focus more on expanding Russian control of the Donbass, the eastern regions. Prior to the war, Russian-backed forces controlled about 35% of the Donbass, and Russia hopes to expand that, as well as a kind of southern corridor that connects the Donbass to the Crimean Peninsula and points further west, including Odessa, possibly to basically turn Ukraine into a landlocked country. The sanctions have tightened on Russia. We've seen the effect on the Russian economy. The focus most recently has been on reducing the imports of Russian fossil fuels, gas, and oil, with the European Union in particular, hoping to really shut off the incoming supplies even earlier than the end of this year, with a couple of countries balking, Hungary and Slovakia in particular. And since we're on the topic of Europe, Finland and Sweden indicating that they are even more eager to join NATO than they had, obviously, before the invasion began. The United States has led the way in providing military assistance with a $33 billion piece of legislation on the table, making its way through Congress with a couple of disagreements, but probably will attract bipartisan support at some point and at some figure. We've seen a lot of high-profile people visiting Ukraine in solidarity with President Zelensky, Boris Johnson, most recently Nancy Pelosi with a delegation of Democratic Party legislators. And then finally, the question of negotiations. Well, where are we with negotiations? And there really hasn't been a lot of movement since the end of March. Ukraine released a 10-point plan, basically, that included neutrality, but the sticking point was really the security guarantees. In other words, what would happen if Ukraine were to be attacked again? Who would come to its assistance? Most recently, Russia has said that sanctions should be part of any negotiated settlement. And Ukraine has said, well, no, that's really up to the folks who are sanctioning you. And it's really not, should not be part of the peace negotiations. So that's a very quick update of where we are right now.
Thank you so much, John. It's really, really helpful. One of the most, I suppose, common questions, it seems, is there's a lot of concern about the information that Russians are getting about this conflict from their media. There's a lot of concern out there, it seems, about misinformation and disinformation. Phyllis, I was perhaps going to ask you if you could talk a little bit about how, is there any possible way to get really accurate information about Putin to the Russian public and what he's doing?
I think that's a really hard question. I think that there's little doubt that people are getting a very distorted view of what's happening in Ukraine, people in Russia. The punishment for journalists or others who report on the war can be up to 15 years in prison. People are being jailed at protests, and the level of repression overall in Russia has significantly increased. With all of that, it's rather astonishing that there has been a continuing anti-war presence that's emerged in Russia. There were protests early on. They're not so frequent now, I think, because of the clampdown. The threat of 15 years in prison is a very serious threat. And journalists are being targeted as well. So it's a very serious repressive environment. I don't see a way that that we have in the United States or in the West where we can take responsibility for getting good information to Russians. I think we have a problem somewhat here in the United States at getting solid information here. I think that one of the ironies of the war in Ukraine is that we are seeing a kind of mobilization of the press in covering this war at a 24/7 level that we have really never seen. We didn't see it around the war in Afghanistan. We didn't see it in Iraq after the first maybe 2 weeks of shock and awe. We stopped seeing that kind of massive coverage. And crucially, what's been interesting in that coverage, and very good, I would say, is that there has been an extraordinary level of focus on humanizing the victims of the war. Not the Russian conscript soldiers, of course, but the Ukrainian civilians and military forces are being humanized in a way that we've never seen with a war around the world. That's all to the good. And it raises the question of extraordinary levels of double standards and racism and hypocrisy about why this war where U.S. forces are not, thankfully, not fighting directly, but the U.S. is clearly supporting one side militarily with massive levels of military assistance, weapons, training, etc. We have not seen this kind of extraordinary humanization of the victims, and it calls into question why we've never seen it in any of the other wars. I think what's important is to keep the focus not on this isn't fair, we shouldn't be seeing this, but rather this is exactly how every war should be covered. This is how every set of refugees should be welcomed and should be covered in the press. You know, these are all the exemplars now of how it should work. And I think it's important that we keep that frame in mind. Coming back to the question of how do we get information to Russians, many Russians do have access to the internet through using, I'm forgetting the acronym, but those private ways of going around the
VPNs.
Shut it down. Right, exactly. Plenty of Russians have access to that. And so they can get access to the information that's happening in the US and elsewhere. And I think that's important as well. But the broader question of what is it going to take for there to be a Russian initiative to challenge this war, it's going to take a great deal because the stakes are so high for individual Russians who are risking their freedom, who are risking their livelihoods, in some cases, maybe risking their lives to do so. So I think that we have to sort of be realistic about what our capacity is. That's not going to be our job. The level of suspicion of US media has a long history in Russia, and it's not unjustified. You know, going back to the Cold War and how the mainstream media in this country covered the Soviet Union, how it covered the collapse of the Soviet Union, how it covered the rise of a capitalist neoliberal Russia, all of that, you know, is not anything that we have to brag about. So I think that we have to be pretty humble, let's say, in terms of our capacity to provide, you know, some great media source for Russians. I think it's a huge challenge that Russians face, but I'm afraid it's something they're going to have to face on their own. I don't see the US being able to provide that. And I don't see the U.S. movements being able to either.
I mean, I have similar things to say as Phyllis, particularly what she ended on, but also to say that, you know, there are folks in Russia, well, I guess I want to emphasize that there are folks in Russia and in the region who are working to do the work of telling the truth about the war, which is part of, you know, they're fighting to advance democracy in Russia and in the region in general. So there's some actually really interesting creative ways that folks in neighboring countries have been connecting with Russians. The US radio program This American Life did a story about how Lithuanians have actually found who speak Russian have found ways to communicate with ordinary Russians by calling them on the phone and just talking to them about the news that they're seeing. So that kind of thing is happening in the region. And then there is really this incredibly, I mean, Phyllis spoke to it a bit, but this amazingly inspiring and heroic community of journalists, and Russian journalists, who for years and years have been doing courageous work and continue to. I mean, we might get into this, but I was kind of, before the webinar, I was looking into, is it possible for, what are independent media or journalistic outfits in Russia that people here might want to donate to? To support that kind of work. And an irony is actually because of the US sanctions, actually, I think that we're prevented from doing so. It's also complicated by the fact that these, for reasons that Phyllis said, these organizations don't want to be associated either ideologically or legally with foreign agents in the US. So that speaks to some of the complications there, but I think that we can be quite inspired by the work that people in Russia and neighboring countries are doing. The other point I wanted to make is just that as we are moved by what is happening in Ukraine, it is an opportunity and I think a real call for those of us here to interrogate the ways that we get information. You know, I remember, for example, when the US invaded Iraq, it was quite common. It was sort of standard practice for the mainstream media outlets here to have embedded journalists, which were necessarily broadcasting to the U.S. what the U.S. military wanted us to see. So it's good to see, and there's a kind of revelation, I think, to many people in this country, what repression and what restrictions on information and democracy look like in a Russian context. And we shouldn't leave it there. We should also take it as an opportunity to reflect upon our own society and its wars, and in the ways that information is kind of channeled here as well.
Wonderfully said, Curry. Thank you so much. This next question is for all three of you. I'll start with you. I'll ask you to start, John. The progressive community seems divided on the provision of what Congress and the administration identify as defensive weapons to Ukraine. How do you feel about this, John?
Well, I think the progressive community in the United States, and to a lesser extent in Europe, is divided not just about the nature of the weapons that are provided. I think there's a division over whether weapons should be provided at all, with some segments of the progressive community taking either a traditionally pacifist position or a position that has evolved over time that has been quite against U.S. arms exports wherever they go, but especially into a live conflict. But if we are talking specifically about the nature of the weapons that are being provided, most weapons are dual use at some level. Even the most defensive of weapons, a shield is something that you use to enable you to use a spear. I mean, that is the central contradiction of military hardware. The Chinese ideogram for contradiction is sword and spear, getting to the very nature of this problem of delineating between what is an offensive and a defensive weapon. But let's be honest, for the most part, Ukraine is not launching any kind of offensive activities. Yes, there have been reports of mysterious explosions that have taken place in Russia. There have been reports of drones that may be of Ukrainian origin that have possibly entered Russian territory. It's unclear the extent to which this is, Ukrainian military activity. It's also possible that it is Russian sabotage within, done by anti-war activists within Russia. It's unclear. But regardless of, the nature of these attacks, they are very small collectively when compared with the offensive kind of onslaught that Russia has launched against Ukraine. So my own personal opinion is the Ukrainians have a right to self-defense. It's not just defending that principle. I mean, because it's nice to say, well, they have the right to self-defense and, they can pick up whatever rocks they want to defend themselves. If you believe in the Ukrainian right to self-defense, well, they should have access to the means to that self-defense as well. However, conflicted I personally am about the provision of U.S. military hardware in general, anywhere in the world. But I am committed to Ukrainian self-defense in this case.
Can I just follow up quickly? Does that mean you think, John, that we should be providing them with?
Yes, I personally do. And believe me, this is not an easy position for me to take. And I wrestle. I have wrestled with this issue in the past. But part of it is informed by my experience during the Yugoslav wars, when I actually very much supported an arms embargo. And I did so on principled reasons. I mean, I felt that providing arms to the war in Yugoslavia actually magnified the conflict. It was adding fuel to the fire. But to be honest with you, that was an abstract position that I took. And as I saw during the course of that war, in fact, what it meant was that the Serbians had access to as much weaponry as they wanted, and the Bosnians had access to almost nothing. And what that meant on a practical basis was that Bosnians were dying in the conflict, and they did not have the ability to defend themselves. So I realized rather late in the game that I was wrong, and that an arms embargo in that situation really was aiding asymmetrically the aggressor in the conflict. And I've tried to apply that kind of insight to this conflict as well.
Thanks for that, John. I do have a different approach. I would note, I mean, ironically, you mentioned, this rather cynically, I think, when you said that Ukrainians would have the right if we didn't provide the weapons, would have the right to use whatever rocks they wanted to defend themselves. That is a right, we should note, that is not granted to Palestinians, to use rocks to defend themselves against tanks that we pay for and provide. So there is a question here of why this war, et cetera. My own view is that the US should not be providing any more weapons, should not be providing weapons at all. I didn't support the earlier ones. I don't support the new $20.5 billion that the Biden administration has just proposed within a $33 billion supplemental grant of aid to Ukraine. I'm not, at least at this stage, calling for a global arms embargo against Ukraine. I think that other governments and other people's movements will make decisions about the impact of weapons from their country going to Ukraine. But I think the problem for me in terms of seeing this, yes, as a situation in the war on the ground, there is no question in my mind, and I think most of us agree, that Russia is the aggressor. There is another war, if you will, as Professor Richard Falk describes it, being waged in political war, in which the United States and Russia are facing off. And the United States, by many accounts, is the aggressor in that war in a much longer process. That's not the ground war. That's the ideological war that's underway, economic, et cetera. But in the context of the ground war, there is no question that Russia is the aggressor. And I do think that Ukrainians have the right of self-defense. I don't think that means that the United States, the most powerful and militarily and economically most powerful country in the world, should be coming in as a partisan in that war, which we have done. The US is a part of that war. And I think to say that for a change, the US is coming in on the right side is a very dangerous reality, because we know from experience what happens when the US goes to war. It involves the militarization, as we're now seeing across Europe, the expansion of NATO, the notion of NATO as a defensive military alliance has never been true since 1991, at least, when the whole question of what is NATO was up for grabs. And instead of saying NATO was designed to challenge the Soviet Union is no more, NATO should dissolve itself, declare victory and go home. Instead of that, NATO became an offensive, out-of-region power where it proceeded to go to war in 1999 in Kosovo, in 2011 in Libya, in 2003 in Iraq, in 2001 in Afghanistan. So the notion of NATO as a defensive reality has simply not been the case, at least for several decades. In that context, we know what happens as a result of the US providing weapons. It's going to be a huge bonanza, already is, for the corporations that get already half of the US military budget. We know that the billions of dollars that are now being added to the budget is objectively taking money away, not only for social programs that are desperately needed in this country and around the world, but also taking it away from diplomacy. The entire budget this year of the State Department is something like about $34 billion. The US is now proposing to give $33 billion for war in Ukraine. That means that the State Department remains completely underfunded. It was hollowed out during the years of the Trump administration and has not been rebuilt. We don't have even the diplomats that we need to carry out aggressive diplomacy that's needed to help bring an end to this war. I'm afraid that by spending these billions on expanding the war, we're going to see greater militarization around the world. Certainly, it's already emerging across Europe and in Japan and elsewhere. And we're going to see a continuation of this war that's going to lead to more Ukrainians dying and more young Russian recruits dying as well. There's already been over 15,000 that have been killed, Russians that we're talking about, not Ukrainians. So I think that it is not in the interest of a diplomatic solution that we all claim to support to be flooding the country with this amount of money. The GDP, the gross domestic product of Ukraine in 2020, which was the last available year, was $155 billion. adding another $33 billion to that, it's not even clear that Ukraine has the capacity to absorb all of that, except in the form of weapons. And I think that expanding this this war militarily is not in the interest of forcing a level of diplomacy that is yet escaping us, that is yet outside of our reach. That needs to be the focus. And I don't think that billions more for weapons accomplishes that.
Thank you so much for that, Phyllis. Corey, I'd like to hear your perspective on this. And there's a really interesting kind of back and forth happening here. I mean, I think there's a general kind of reticence about the prospect of us, by us, I mean the US, providing weapons to the Ukrainians, but also an acknowledgement of the fact that they should be able to defend themselves, right? So it's a really difficult issue to parse here. I was wondering how you're sort of weighing this and what your conclusions are.
Yeah, I mean, it's one reason why I think that this conversation is really important, you know, and I really appreciate what John is saying and appreciate the kind of, I mean, that kind of the difficulty and the conflicted, you know, feelings I think all of us have, you know, in different ways, you know, like I appreciate, John, your articulation of that. And I, you know, I have arrived at a different position also, you know, I also agree with the idea that I'm not for calling for an arms embargo. And I do believe in the right of Ukrainians for self-defense. But I guess what I'll say that maybe is a little different is that, you know, we have that sentiment. We have sympathies with the people of Ukraine. And I think that we should not assume that the U.S. government is doing what it's doing because it has the same exact sympathies. It may appear so, you know, like we might say, oh, you know, this is so horrific what's happening to Ukraine. And then the U.S. steps in and says, well, we've got this weapons package. And we shouldn't assume that those are motivated by the same, they're driven by the same motivations. When I'll just name a couple of things that are deeply concerning. One is that for the U.S., I think this is an opportunity to, having identified Russia for at least two decades as a potential challenge or rival to U.S. power in the world, this is an opportunity to see a weaker Russia emerge from this, you know, and if Ukraine happens to be the context for that to happen, then so be it, from you know, as far as Washington is concerned. The other thing, and this gets at some of the bigger, broader regional and geopolitical kind of structural things that Phyllis spoke to, you know, $33 billion is not a gift, it's an investment. I mean, when we consider the top recipients of US aid around the world and the expectation of what the US expects, you know, as part of that relationship, when the US gives aid to Israel, for example, or to Saudi Arabia or to Egypt, there's an understanding of what role those states are going to play in that region and its alignment with U.S. interests. It's more or less an open conversation, actually, in Washington. And frankly, you know, when Zelensky talks too about imagining a Ukraine after this war, and he says it's going to look like Israel. I mean, I think he's signaling a number of things with that, but certainly the expectation that Ukraine and actually a number of states will be more vocal, more adamant in the kind of advancing a certain set of interests that the U.S. supports, and not just more vocal, but armed to assert those things. I think that's the calculation in Washington, and that's deeply troubling. It's really moving. The hope is that by sending weapons, it can lead to demilitarization. I'm afraid it's the opposite.
Well, you know, I remember conversations I had with folks at the American Friends Service Committee back in the late 1980s. And AFSC, of course, is a Quaker organization, and therefore very much aligned with pacifist, robust pacifist, I should say, positions. And yet there was a very strong conversation at that time about whether we could support armed liberation movements. And there were a lot of us in the organization who said, look, you know, we believe in nonviolence. We believe in demilitarization. We're very much against US military budget, et cetera. But, you know, in some cases, if people come together, they feel they need to use arms for the purpose of liberation. Now, this was, of course, a different kind of conversation than we're having now, but I'm reminded of it because it was a similar kind of struggle of dealing with one's values, which were very much aligned with demilitarization, and the realities of the world, which were very different from, say, the conversations taking place in Northampton, Massachusetts, or, you know, Tempe, Arizona. And, you know, if there were a country like Austria that was providing $33 billion worth of military assistance to Ukraine, I would say, hey, of course, United States, we don't need to have a dog in that game, as James Baker famously said about our approach to Yugoslavia back in the 1990s. We can afford to stand back. But that's not the case. And yes, I totally agree with Phyllis and Corrie about concerns about further militarization of our society, the consequences of military aid and the strings attached to them. I don't, however, see that there is a necessary relationship, unfortunately, between provision of aid and the diplomatic alternatives, because that somehow implies that there's a robust diplomatic effort underway that Russia is all behind. As I mentioned, you know, there was some momentum at the end of March. Ukraine released its 10 points, which included neutrality. Russia continues to push its maximalist agenda, maybe not as maximalist as it was at the beginning, since it obviously failed to achieve its initial objectives, but maximalist in terms of territorial acquisition, maximalist in terms of basically population transfer. I mean, this is... We're not only talking about war crimes in terms of killing of civilians, but we're talking about a really unbelievable relocation of Ukrainians from areas of Mariupol in southern Ukraine and in the Donbass against their will to areas inside Russia, basically echoing the population transfers that took place under Stalin during the Soviet period. These go beyond, all of this goes beyond kind of quote unquote normal, you know, wartime activities. So I do not see Russia as at this point supporting in any meaningful way diplomacy. And so I do think that it is unfortunate, but true, that the provision of military assistance by the United States and other countries is not at the moment undercutting a diplomatic initiative. I'm hoping that, in fact, and God knows I do not like this relationship, but I'm hoping that some form of military stalemate will push the Putin administration to be, shall we say, more compromising at the negotiating table. Again, I do not like to say that because I do not like to push this relationship between aggression and eventual peace negotiations. But when dealing with the current Russian position, I'm unfortunately having to take that.
Phyllis, I'd love to get your view on this, especially the notion that the kind of provision of weapons to Ukrainians might actually push this crisis in the direction of diplomacy. It's a really interesting perspective.
I appreciate John's view on that. Unfortunately, I don't think that it works that way. I think the notion that Russia will be more likely to negotiate with a US-backed force, and that's what we have to recognize, is negotiations with Ukraine is all about. It's negotiating with the US and NATO through Ukraine. The notion that that's going to be more likely as a result of a massive, this is really $33 billion is really massive escalation in US involvement in the war. I think that's, it's quite the opposite. I'm afraid that it's going to make diplomacy even more difficult, that Russia is going to feel even more cornered and lash out. And when we're talking about nuclear armed protagonists here, any possibility, and I think it's not likely, but it's not zero. And if it's anything other than zero, to me, that's a huge consideration in looking at the threats of a new level of escalation. The other thing I think is that's so important for us to keep in mind, no one in Congress is saying a word about the consequences of spending $33 billion suddenly, even beyond the $800 billion military budget that's on call for next year. And that just if we look at the $20 billion, not even the whole $33 billion, because it's not all for military, most of it is, $20 billion of it is aimed at direct military contracts, mainly to U.S. military contractors. You know, places like Boeing are going to make a killing in all ways on these budget escalations. That $20 billion would also pay for 2.4 public housing units for a year. It would pay for 558,000 jobs at $15 an hour with benefits for a year. It could get healthcare for 6.9 million children across this country. And that's just a sample of what that same $20 billion could be used for. So it's not as if this is just $20 billion kind of floating around the world that, well, why not? You know, this is a just cause. And the final thing I want to say, just in response to John's earlier point about his conversations with AFSC, I had many conversations like that 10 years earlier during the Vietnam era, as opposed to the Central America era, where we did support the Vietnamese and their right to fight back. Certainly, we weren't in any position to provide military support. God forbid that that should have been sort of on the agenda, but we supported their military forces. We wanted the Vietnamese to win the war. And in that context, I think what was important, which I don't think is the case here, is that it wasn't only a matter of the question of self-determination and they have a right to their own country. We also supported the social program they were trying to build. And they did build. It didn't last very long, unfortunately, as we know in Vietnam. The same has been true in other countries. But at the time that they were fighting, the kind of new society they were talking about building with equality economically, equality for women, all of those things, for socialism, these were all things that we supported. And that was part of the reason for supporting even a military component of these struggles. That was true in Central America. It was true in South Africa in the anti-apartheid struggle. In all of those regions, it was because we supported what the other side was fighting for. I understand that Ukrainians are fighting for survival as an independent country. And that's an important thing for sure. That's how the world is organized, is in nation states. But to me, that's not the same. What Ukraine was before and what Zelensky says it's going to be after, only on steroids, if we use his example of we want to be like Israel, and he made these specific comparisons to we should be expecting to see armed civilians and our soldiers in every movie theater and every supermarket. That was Zelensky's description of what post-war Ukraine should look like. I'm not interested in creating that. So it's a different situation, I think, when you actually support what they're trying to build, as opposed to you support their right to fight back against an oppression such as they're facing with the Russian invasion and occupation, but they're not the same thing. So I think that's where we come down to different conclusions about this $20 billion of military and $13 billion more in other kinds of assistance to Ukraine.
Just a quick comment on the question of social program. I mean, I have two kind of responses to that. One, to a certain extent, social program is not really relevant. I mean, if you're talking about a country that's been invaded and is fighting for its survival, I mean, what social program the current government imagines for the country, it shouldn't really determine whether we support it or not. What we're supporting is its survival. But on the question of social program, I mean, I prefer to think, look, Zelensky is basically a libertarian from a libertarian party. Not my cup of tea necessarily. Better than, of course, right-wing fascists. Not as good, in my opinion, as democratic socialists. But anyway, libertarians. It's what he is. It's what their program is. But in terms of a vision of where Ukraine is heading, okay, Israel, I mean, there are a lot of connotations when you say Israel. I think what Zelensky meant was a country that's in some sense under siege from his point of view. But the end point for Ukraine is today the same as it was prior to the invasion. That's to be a member of the European Union. And that's something I can get behind.
And NATO. He wanted to be in NATO.
But that's largely off the
agreed. But it is a goal. It is a goal. It's not on the table. right now?
Well, I mean, honestly, yeah. Phyllis, if you've been invaded, you know, to be part of an alliance that provides for collective self-defense, it's hard not to be enthusiastic about that. And it's understandable why Sweden and Finland, who, you know, hitherto were not enthusiastic about joining NATO, suddenly are more enthusiastic. And again, I mean, I've spent 25 years arguing that NATO is anachronistic, that we should have been building other security frameworks or strengthening the OSCE. I wrote a piece in 1996 about the dangers of NATO expansion that talks specifically about how it would divide Ukraine. In 1996, I wrote this. I don't disagree with anything I wrote back then. However, I can understand at this point, after an invasion, why NATO suddenly looks more attractive than it did before. But on the question of social program, you know, the EU and membership for Ukraine in the EU seems to me like a pretty good thing. And when we compare it to what the social program is of Putin and his, you know, klepto oligarchs, well, that's not a social program I'm at any level in support of. Question is, you know, what might things evolve to inside Russia? But I do know that if Russia were to take over Ukraine and apply its model to the country, we would have suddenly a social system that I would find repugnant. And unfortunately, that would be a peace of sorts. And that's not the peace that I would accept, because that's, you know, that's certainly one possible scenario endpoint for this conflict, in which we get peace, but it's a peace that's bought at the expense of Ukrainian sovereignty, the existence of potentially Ukrainian culture, and at the expense of a lot of Ukrainians, and frankly, Russian soldiers as well, who have died as a result of this peace.
One thing that is largely missing, and that I think that we, one of the key takeaways, I think, from this entire experience has to be a commitment to rebuilding a global movement against war in general, so that popular resistance and popular power is a factor in this whole thing. So it isn't just which efforts by which state do you hope prevails, you know, in this thing, but actually organized anti-war forces around the world actually can be a factor to support, to invest in, to commit to build, et cetera, so that we can have a popular intervention. And I'll, you know, I'll take exception with one thing that John said, which was about the nature, you know, the nature of this invasion. And I appreciate how indescribably violent and horrendous it is. But the notion that this level of displacement is beyond the bounds of normal warfare, like I'm sorry to say that it is profoundly normal for millions of people around the world to be displaced. I mean, what's happening in Ukraine in this amount of weeks at this scale, yes, is catastrophic. But this is when I think about when I think about what's happening in Ethiopia right now, for example, among many, many other places, when I think about places like Palestine, which have had at this point several generations of displaced refugees, it is among other things points to the need to really reconstruct the kind of popular anti-war resistance that emerged actually on the eve of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, but of course in a much more sustained way, because, you know, I think that we've lost that. That needs to be rebuilt, and I think rebuilt informed by the violence and the crises of various states, you know, in regions around the world. It's not enough to have this either we oppose U.S. violence or we oppose Russian violence. There's when we take a step back and look at war and militarism shaping the reality for many, many people around the globe, it means that we need to build something from the bottom up that takes this on and intervenes in a different way.
Thanks, Corey. I'd like to pick up that thread. Your last point about sort of a mass response to this, you know, people power. And John, I'd like to ask you I think we all on this sort of call want diplomacy. What are concrete ways that ordinary citizens can support diplomacy, John?
I'll just say that there are, and there have been kind of Gene Sharp type approaches by people on the ground in Ukraine resisting Russian authority. For instance, just recently, the Russians on May 1st imposed the ruble on Kherson, the only kind of city, major city that they took over, and a real indication that they have some intention of consolidating political and administrative control over the southern tier. But many people in that city have just said, well, you know, we're just going to immediately turn our rubles into Ukrainian currency. We're not going to accept Russian ruble here. And another way of basically rejecting Russian authority on the ground, it's not military, I mean, although there's plenty of military responses as well. But as to your question, Tope, of what people can do to support diplomacy. Even in the best of circumstances, it is hard for citizens to become involved in diplomacy. Of course, we've had citizen diplomacy and a rich tradition of that, delegations going to countries that are considered to be adversaries of the United States to meet with people, to build bridges. And there's a proud tradition, and I hope that we can continue that with Russia and that we can continue to emphasize that this is a war that is promulgated by the Russian government, and it is not the Russian people who, I mean, many of them may support the war, but the Russian people aren't necessarily connected to this war. We cannot assume that all Russians support this war, even though the popularity rating for Putin himself has risen. Thousands and thousands of Russians have protested against this war and otherwise demonstrated their disgust for what is going on here. Reaching out to those folks, reaching out to whether they're within Russia or outside of Russia, as far as I'm concerned, is part of citizen diplomacy. It's building up people power against the powers that are pushing war, primarily in Moscow, but elsewhere as well. I think that's the most effective kind of diplomatic effort we can do. Of course, we can continue to support refugees. And as Khoury pointed out, it's not just Ukrainian refugees who are circulating around the world. So, we have to be even-handed in our approach to refugees and opening our doors, not just to folks from Ukraine. But that is another way of being diplomatic, of engaging in the process of diplomacy on a very, very one-to-one basis, and otherwise supporting humanitarian efforts. The actual face-to-face of Ukrainian, government officials and Russian government officials, not so easy to influence. Of course, we can continue to press our government to support diplomacy in general, even as we send arms, even as we, say mean things about the Russians. We can still, as a U.S. government, support diplomatic efforts, give our support for other third-party negotiators who, frankly, because of U.S. history, could be far more effective in bringing the two sides together, whether that might be the Turks, it might be, the Bulgarians. I mean, it could be other folks from the region. But it's absolutely critical for the United States to, whatever way we can, build that space and expand that space for diplomacy. And it is our job as U.S. citizens to encourage our government to do that.
Thank you, John. Phyllis, I was wondering if you had some words on this.
I do. I agree with most of John's proposals of what needs to happen, but I would add a few other things. I think that the militarization of U.S. foreign policy has been a very serious problem for at least the last 20 years and before that to a significant degree as well. And I think that's our obligation to push. When we look at the budgets, Martin Luther King taught us that budgets are moral documents. And our moral commitment right now is pretty much tanking in this country, in my view. When we look at the budgets, we're looking at a budget of 35, $1 billion for the entire State Department, when we're throwing $33 billion without a hint of investigation or oversight by Congress at a war, at one particular war, it's ensuring that we're not going to have the diplomatic clout to make anything happen, like the revitalization of the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. That's who should be organizing diplomacy. This is an organization that is a political and diplomatic organization, not a military organization like NATO, that is charged with maintaining peace and human rights across all of Europe. And both Russia and Ukraine and all of Western Europe and all of the rest of Europe are all members of it. Of course, so is Canada and the US, who seem to think that they should be, you know, have the right to be part of every regional area, every regional organization, whether they happen to be in that region or not. But okay, it involves everybody in Europe. There's a political basis there to say, oh, that's who should maybe be in charge here. The US is facing a scenario which we've been seeing dramatically rising over recent decades, where when somebody in Congress wants to do something good somewhere, I remember talking to this one member of Congress a few years ago who said, you know, I was on a delegation in several African countries. And in one place in particular, I think he was talking about Cameroon, I don't quite remember. He said, you know, we spent a day in a small town. And what was clear was there was a lot of potential for massive improvement of people's lives if they could get more access to fresh water, and they needed to dig a well and didn't have whatever it is that hydrologists need to dig a well, whatever the equipment was. And it was several tens of thousands of dollars. It was like, it was chump change. It was absolute chump change in Congress. And he tried to get it through some committee and they were like, no, we don't have any money for that. Go talk to the Pentagon. And he was like, what? Why would I go talk to the Pentagon? Because they have the money. And he went and he talked to somebody in the congressional liaison's office at the Pentagon who said, oh yeah, we can do that, no problem. And full stop, the well was dug. Yay, everybody cheered, the US military. And what happens? The military takes over the decision-making about what's a legitimate political / diplomatic initiative and what isn't. That's what we're looking at here again. You know, it's not to say that I'm such a fan of how US diplomacy has always worked. Sometimes it's been pretty crummy and it has served as a force multiplier, that's the Pentagon's language, for Pentagon initiatives. You know, why is it that in Afghanistan, you know, we have this intersection of military and diplomatic initiatives? It's because the military has all the money. So if we're giving $20 billion to, Congress is going to give it to the Defense Department to pay out to military contractors so they can build more bombs and more warplanes and more weapons and more ammunition and more tanks and send all that to Ukraine and cheering them on. At the same time, we're allowing the hollowing out of the State Department, including its budget and its staff, to stand. We're allowing that to be incapable of doing anything. And that's a huge problem, not only for today, where it's a problem for the whole world, but also in the future where we can see it getting worse, you know? So I think that these are the kinds of things that we have to take very seriously. And I absolutely understand why people in Ukraine are demanding, as President Zelensky does, urging, crying for US military support. We've seen this before. We saw it in Libya. We saw it in Syria, where people, not just the military, not just officials, people called out and wanted US military support. And we were opposed to it because we understood what the consequences would be. And it's horrifying to say to somebody who is fighting for their lives, we want your military support. And we're like, we really don't think it's going to work. You know, the fact that people are desperate makes it understandable why they're desperate for military weapons. And those of us who are privileged to be outside of that desperation also have an obligation to figure out as best we can what's going to have a more dangerous impact later and to say, we're so sorry, but it can't happen that way. And we've done that before. We've done it. Many of us are doing it now for Ukraine. It's never easy. It's always painful. It doesn't mean we're necessarily going to be right every single time, but we have to make the best judgment we can, not only looking at today when Ukrainians are dying and Russian soldiers are dying and far too many people are dying, to say we don't think that sending $20 billion more weapons is going to save more lives. We understand why you're desperate and calling out for it, but we're going to say no, we're sorry. And that's an awful position to be in. But I think it's the more principled one, ultimately, when we look at how diplomacy is going to have any chance of replacing a military conflict.
That was a recent panel discussion hosted by the Institute for Policy Studies on the conflict in Ukraine, featuring Phyllis Bennis, Jean Pfeffer, and Curry Peterson Smith. I hope you found that thought-provoking, as that is what we hope to do every week here on this show, Conscious Voices, on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, the community festival's coming up on the last weekend in June in Goodale Park, and both radio stations do need volunteers to help staff our shop there, staff our booth, rather, and hand out flyers and information and just kind of do a general public meet and greet with volunteers at the radio station and listeners like you. I hope to see you there, and I'll hope you'll be with us again next week for another edition of this show. Take care.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night. While the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. Through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down Gaza tonight. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in the night without a fight. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.